Hola, Sol. Oh, yeah. So we will continue, of course, with mindfulness of breathing. And an extremely brief footnote to last night. If you were wondering what I was reading from, it's a book that I wrote, published 13 years ago, called The Taboo of Subjectivity. Put a lot of research into it. I enjoyed writing it. And in terms of that theme, and again, very briefly, that if there are such things as spirits, frankly, I don't really care that much. But it's kind of interesting if this planet is populated by beings who are not just animals and human beings, but as pretty much all other civilizations assert, by a wide variety of much less tangible beings who may be physical, but only in a very subtle level, kind of prana-physical. But prana is not something that science can measure anyway, but it's still physical. If they're there, it would be kind of interesting to know. And as you notice right out here in the front of our mind center here, they're the spirit houses. They're all over Southeast Asia. And that's kind of good manners. You know, if you move into a place, then you create friendly relationships with the people who are already there and their spirits. You know, so the smaller ones, I think the lower one is kind of more for the earth spirits, and then there's a higher, kind of nicer one, and that's for the more celestial kind of spirits. But if they do exist, obviously they won't be measured, could never have never been, will never be measured by the conventional methods of modern science, which is designed to measure physical things. And coarse physical things, material things. And so if they do exist, then they will be measured by a mode of observation that can actually detect, observe carefully, non-physical phenomena. And there is one. You might have noticed it. And so shamatha, of course, because it's the only means that we know of for actually observing thoughts, images, and everything else we've been observing in the space of the mind. And it's widely known in Buddhism and very clearly articulated by Atisha that the door to developing extrasensory perception, remote viewing, precognition, clairaudience, and so forth, a wide variety, they're called abhijna, or heightened modes of knowledge, is shamatha. And also for developing paranormal abilities. Again, the key to that is shamatha. And you might recall, because I've quoted it many times, Atisha says in his Lamp on the Path to Enlightenment, the first lamrim ever composed that he wrote for Tibetans about 1,000 years ago, he said that once you've developed shamatha and on the basis of that developed some paranormal abilities, you know, with a benevolent, compassionate motivation, not just a power trip at all, but so you can be much more effective in serving the needs of others. He says the merit you can accumulate, remember, the merit you can accumulate in one day is greater than the merit you can accumulate in 100 lifetimes. So rather big order of magnitude, something like 3 million to 1. So, here we are in shamatha. We come back to this. We'll come back to mindfulness of breathing. With the idea, first of all, to balance the mind, to heal the mind, to make the mind serviceable. In the very process, we're finding, of course, that there's a lot of self-knowledge. All of you are reporting your experiences. You're not just reporting this or that in terms of what's happening to you, but also what's coming up. And so it's a path of self-knowledge. But my sense is that substrate consciousness is really a portal, like an entryway. Number one, it's called the threshold. You know, when you tap into that by way of shamatha, it's the threshold to the form realm. But Dujum Limba, when he unpacks this, or Padmasambhava in the Vajra Essence and the other mind treasures, he says you tap into that, and you can tap into, from there, you can go to the desire realm, of course, but a wide variety of phenomena in the desire realm. You can also tap into the form realm, but you can also go into the formless realm. It's really like a portal to all of these realms of samsara, that one. Because it's kind of, it's not a limbo, but it's undefined. It's a stem cell. It's a stem state of consciousness. So it's not human, but it's not animal. It's not preta. It's not deva. It's not anything. It's just kind of ready to go, whatever direction you wish to go. And then also for then developing these extraordinary abilities, these potentials or powers of consciousness, that's your baseline. That's your new base camp. So, without further ado, I said it would be short, and lo and behold, it's going to be short. Let's go right to our first session. Please find a comfortable position. And now that we've covered all three of the modes of shamatha that I commonly teach, as well as the fourth, the method of asanga, let's go back to mindfulness of breathing. And I want to have this be a silent session, so please simply choose the method that you find most beneficial to yourself. And we'll come back and look at the next stage out of the 9 stages of shamatha. So this will not be recorded, or no need to record. So we turn now to the next of the nine stages, the fifth stage. It's called tamed attention. So kind of obvious what that means. And this transition from the fourth to the fifth is quite famous. It's been famous for at least 1,500 years or so. In the sense of now, it's become more than ever a very subtle balancing act. And I noted that yesterday, that it's not just overcoming coarse excitation, but it's, okay, you've handled that. So you have a new, kind of a new base camp. You have a new foundation or platform. You can maintain some real continuity for the duration of your session. But now this whole issue of overcoming medium excitation with its relevant antidotes, and overcoming coarse laxity. And what yogis have been finding for centuries and centuries, in other words, again, a very large database here, is kind of meeting with some frustration. And that is when they see the laxity, and just like stringing a very fine instrument, then they crank it up, they increase the pitch. That's actually the word that Tsongkhapa uses. They increase the pitch of attention. So they make it finer, a bit tauter, right? But when they do that, they find the mind starts to flutter. It kind of gets destabilized. Agitation starts coming in. And they maybe find they're falling back into coarse excitation. They say, whoops, that's wrong, because they've already been there. And they say, okay, now loosen up a bit. I know. So excitation, loosen up. And then they see the coarse laxity coming in. They say, oh, no, not that. Okay, well, okay, tighten up. Oh, no, there's coarse. And so back and forth and kind of like, oh, man, how do I get out of this? And the practice, of course, I think you already know the answer. Keep working on it. Because it's a balancing act, and the balancing gets finer and finer and finer. So, what is achieved? So now, you'll recall what was achieved there on that fourth stage was that you can no longer, that you can remain continuously on your object. And now what you achieve is a sense of satisfaction, unprecedented degree of satisfaction. Once you've moved over there to the fifth out of nine stages, it's really like something like you cross the watershed, where the water flows this way and the water flows that way. Quite numerically, of course, you can have. If it's nine stages, then you've just moved from the fourth to the fifth, so you're kind of, you know, coming down the backside. And so a sense of satisfaction. Okay, that's the first point. And the power by which you achieve it, and this is very, very important, is introspection. Now, you note that previously, introspection wasn't even mentioned. It was the power of hearing, the power of thinking, the power of mindfulness. Now, for the first time, introspection. Well, of course, you needed introspection all along, but now is the time you really need to be using it and refining it. So you already have it. All of us can monitor our minds to some degree, I think. But now you're not only utilizing that faculty, but you really have to sharpen it up. Because if you don't, you're just going to be wobbling back and forth, wobbling back and forth between the medium excitation and the coarse laxity. So the faculty by which you achieve this, wait a minute. Oh, there we go, there it is. Introspection is introspection. So now it's really coming in as a full partner to your other major faculty, and these are the two, of course, mindfulness and introspection, the dynamic duo, so to speak. But what's interesting here is the problems persist is although you're taking satisfaction in the practice, there's also some resistance to samadhi. So an ambivalence. And it's very interesting. A lot of this is not something you simply predict if you never meditated, but you just thought a lot about it, right? So this shows this is truly experiential and not just some kind of Buddhist philosopher dreaming this up. What would it be like if I were to practice shamatha? And so some resistance comes up. So on the one hand, you're taking satisfaction. On the other hand, some degree of resistance. It's quite interesting. There's an ambivalence there. And now we go on to the attentional imbalances that still plague you or to which you're still prone on this fifth stage. And this is medium laxity and medium excitation. So you see, you've not made a whole lot of progress or not really anything really distinctive in terms of excitation. That is, you haven't lost ground. You remember in the very beginning, I know you all do, very beginning, stage one, what's your task? Relax more and just don't lose the clarity you have. Remember? Relax more. So the other one, in other words, you're not trying to make progress on all fronts equally. That is, okay, today I'll have to advance more in terms of stillness and more in terms of vividness. It's more like, okay, we're going to emphasize this one without losing the other. So in the first stage, the very first one, that is initial, you know, foundational stage of mindfulness of breathing, Now really relax much more deeply and just don't lose the clarity you already had. And now we can infer, since you're still subject to medium excitation, right? Okay, just maintain that degree of stillness you have, but now enhance the clarity. Okay? Quite cool. So you're subject now only to medium laxity. You have now overcome, you've outgrown coarse laxity, which was your big problem there, again, together with complacency. On stage four, you've moved beyond coarse laxity, but you're still there in the realm of medium excitation. So now it's medium, so kind of an even, obviously a parity between the two. And to go to medium laxity, we're going down there in the notes. In this case, medium laxity, the object appears, but not with much vividness. So obviously that's a 100% qualitative statement. Not much vividness. What on earth does that mean? I mean, the clarity is the attention is there. You're on the object, but with not much vividness. Well, it's not a meaningless statement. It's not much compared to what you've tasted. Okay, you know when you're on the fifth stage, you know what it's like. You know what it's like to be free of medium laxity. You taste that. You get it again and again, and what this implies is you've seen what it's like to have an exceptional degree of clarity, vividness, the likes of which you would very rarely have down on the lower stages. So you're entering into that time and again, some really exceptional clarity. But then relative to that, you see, oh, that's not there anymore. So it's entirely internal. So you're setting your own parameters, your own measuring marks, so to speak, right? And they're going to get finer and finer and finer as you go. But within this bandwidth, you'll experience sometimes really good clarity, and other times you're still engaged with the object. You're not kind of floating off like that. But you see, you have that sense, very clear internal relative sense. It's not as good as it has been. And that's relative laxity, okay? And then the relative excitation, of course, is as before. So, and then we can wrap this up pretty quickly. The type of mental engagement is still interrupted, and now what this means, interrupted for some time now, is that you're still, the flow of your mindfulness is interrupted by excitation and laxity. You really have continuity, of course, but it's interrupted by, in this case, medium laxity. It comes, and then you overcome it. Medium excitation comes, and you overcome it. Meanwhile, on a coarse level, you are on the object. But these are interrupting kind of the optimal flow of mindfulness. The quality of the experience, once again, is achievement. If I remember correctly, that was the sense last time. Yep. And so it's still a sense of achievement. You know you've really gotten somewhere. You're no longer a rank amateur. And likewise, and again, bear in mind this is now with respect to settling the mind in its natural state, the flow of involuntary thoughts is still likened to a river quickly flowing through a gorge. So between stages 4 and 5, you don't sense any really significant change in terms of the sheer volume of thoughts, emotions, memories, desires, and so forth that are coming to mind. But of course, there is progress. I just want to reemphasize this point. There is progress, but as Tsongkhapa makes a very strong point, it's a very interesting one as well. When we talk about stability and vividness, and he was emphasizing vividness in this particular passage, when we speak of the vividness of your attention, if you start really getting professional here and fine-tuning what you mean by that, vividness, you already know. But now let's couch the question in this way. Vividness, is this the vividness of how the object appears to you, the degree of clarity and so forth, or is it more subjective vividness? Because they're not quite the same thing, right? For example, you can have, it's a nice analogy, you can have 20/20 vision, perfectly clear vision, and be looking at a movie that's very low definition. And so all the images, of course, are rather fuzzy, you know, not high def. And so objectively, what you're getting is a rather fuzzy image. Maybe it's even also, maybe you're watching an old television or something like that where the image is not very clear, you know, it's not very bright, and it's a bit fuzzy, and it's very low megapixels, a very low density. But you're sitting there six feet away from the television, and your eyes are 20/20 with a nice bright light on the room. So subjectively, you're perfectly clear. Objectively, what's appearing to you, not that very clear. So now what are we talking about? in shamatha, when we're, you know, so much emphasis here on relaxation, stability, vividness, most explicitly, stability and vividness, and now more explicitly, even vividness. What kind of vividness are we referring to? Objective vividness or subjective vividness? Because we see they're not quite the same, right? What would you be your guess? Anybody want to be bold? Subjective, yeah, exactly right. Subjective vividness. And so I'm going to emphasize that you really need to know this, you know, because when he's teaching meditation, he's right there. He doesn't mince his words. He doesn't just go off meandering. And so it's one more critical point. It's the subjective side, that whatever's coming up, including if you're like settling the mind in its natural state, and you, as far as you can tell, you really are seeing intervals between thoughts. And so you're attending as closely as you can, and all you're getting is a sheer vacuity, right? Well, now, judging by what Eric and Rhonda said, you could then have a very vivid awareness, luminous, because the word is the same, vivid, clear, luminous. They're all the same word in Tibetan, selwa. You could have a very luminous, vivid, clear, sharp, acute, highly awake, vigilant awareness of a sheer vacuity. And the answer is, yeah, that's exactly right. Right? I'll just give, maybe it's not necessary, but we'll give one analogy. And that is, I used to live up in the, near San Francisco, where we'd have very heavy fog, outside of Half Moon Bay, when I was living with Gyatso Rinpoche. And the fog there could be incredibly dense, really thick, really, really thick. And so when we were driving up the winding road, this mountain road, up to the house where we stayed, when it was at night, and then heavy fog, that's dull on top of dull, because it's nighttime and really dense fog, and you're winding, doing this winding road, with no railing or anything like that. And so there was just one more case. You really don't want to die, which means you're very vivid, you're very alert, because it's really easy to, you know, hurt yourself or die. But what you're really alert to is a whole bunch of darkness and fog, clearly illuminated by the headlights of your car. But what you're getting objectively is, man, this is really pea soup fog. And so there it is, between the objective and the subjective. It's really cultivating, or it's unveiling. Because it's not like getting a bigger and bigger battery, you know, or a bigger and bigger light bulb, more wattage. It's just unveiling and unveiling more and more and more the incredible luminosity, the brightness of your substrate consciousness. Right? And so there's that one element. And then, with your background, because all of you had at least some taste of settling the mind in its natural state, I'll ask what is basically a rhetorical question. We have stillness and vividness as the two big qualities to cultivate, rooted in relaxation. And so what's being cultivated here, in terms of the stillness, is it objective stillness or is it subjective stillness? And everybody knows the right answer, so I'll just say it. Of course, it's subjective stillness. And that's why way up there on stage 5, I mean, you're doing pretty well now. You're clearly not a beginner anymore. And so there your stillness is pretty darn good. I mean, you still have medium excitation, but still, ongoing, you're not losing the object entirely. So your stillness is really quite good. And yet, in that practice of settling the mind in its natural state, from stage 4 to 5, no significant difference in terms of the sheer volume of the movements, thoughts, memories, images, and all of that. But there is a difference. Slowly, slowly, there's a difference, and that is with the freedom from grasping, and it's just that, direct correlation, the freedom from grasping in the midst of the movements of the mind, first a cascading waterfall, then this mountain river, you know, gushing down a gorge, the stillness of your awareness is getting finer and finer. You're less moved by coarse, medium, and subtle grasping. Okay? So that's stage 5. Stage 5. Pretty good there. Could be better, but it's pretty good. So, any questions before we go? How's your pertaining specifically to shamatha, or are we wrapped up for this morning? Yes, go ahead, please, Morgan.
I'm just kind of wondering how the stages play out in terms of the awareness of awareness, mm-hmm. like what you would be expecting.
It's a very interesting question. It's the most signless path. The more clearly you're working with a sign, a clear target, which is like likened to a stake driven into the ground, and mindfulness is the rope, and your mind is the elephant that's attached to the rope. Okay, classic image. Well, when you're following mindfulness of breathing, or you're focusing on a Buddha image, a mentally generated image of the Buddha, then those 9 stages really play out quite clearly. You know, because you have a real referent relevant to that object. How am I doing in terms of stability and so forth? Now, it's still relevant when you're practicing shamatha without, settling the mind in its natural state. But it's not nearly as emphasized. I mean, I've read a number of accounts now. Pension Rinpoche, I'm moving into your question, but I think the context is important. I'm not just rambling. But Pension Rinpoche, in his text on the Mahamudra in which we covered the shamatha, he says, no matter what method you follow, if you achieve shamatha, you will be going through those 9 stages. Right? Just like if you're a baby and you want to get to adolescence, you will be 3'0" and 3'1". You won't skip any of those. You won't, right? You will go through all of the stages until you grow to your adult height. And so he's saying, it's the same way. It's a big claim. It's a very interesting and it's a very strong claim. He said, this is how the mind evolves when you really develop your attention contemplatively and you get all the way to shamatha. Whether you go fast or slow, whether you go evenly or unevenly, you're going to go through those 9 stages. Okay, but looking at the Dzogchen literature, especially the Dzogchen literature, where the practice of settling the mind comes up a lot. It's the major method taught in that context. Often there's no reference to the 9 stages at all. Lhayudap Lingpa never even mentions them. It's a complete teaching he gives. Doesn't even mention the 9 stages. And then once, Rinpoche, I think, was being a bit ironic with me. My Lama Gyatso Rinpoche, many years ago, I was in a very strict 6-month retreat, practicing just this, settling the mind in its natural state. That was it. But I would come down about once a month. I'd drive about 20 minutes in a truck to get to the nearest public telephone, phone him up, ask for advice, and then go back up to my mountain retreat. And at one point, the issue of the mental stages came up, and I posed a question. And I think it was about stage 4 or something. And he said, what's that? He said, what's that? He's been trained since he was a child. And this is like learning out, arithmetic. And so what he was basically telling me is, I'm not going to go there. All you need to be focusing on, and he was really clear with me on this point, all you need to do is just be focusing on the practice. Don't worry about that much. Those 9 stages, set them aside. Just do the practice. And then he emphasized also, you might, because I've told this story many times, it's a one-liner of a story pretty much. But remember he told me, Alan, you're practicing with too much desire. Remember that one? Here I am practicing, only in mine is natural state. And he said, Alan, you're practicing with too much desire. And I'm really all for dialogue and not just listening to the Lama and saying whatever you say, but dialogue, I want to understand. So he said, well, Rinpoche, I don't really feel that. That as I'm doing my practice and I'm not thinking about money or sex or fame or all that stuff, all the hedonic stuff, it's not really coming to mind much at all. I'm really just focusing on the practice. So what do you mean? And he said, I'm not referring to that. I'm not referring to sensual pleasures and money and all that. I'm not referring to that. When you're doing the practice itself, when you're in the practice, you're practicing with too much desire for the fruits of the practice. Too much desire. And of course, he was spot on right. He was phoning me from 1,000 miles away. I was phoning him. But there it is. The practice is when you're doing that, settling the mind, all you really need to know is right now, am I doing this practice correctly? That's all you need to know. You don't need to know how it's going to turn out at the end of the session or how you'll be in 1 month or how long it's going to take. All you need to know is, am I doing it correctly right now? And be satisfied with that. Be content with that. That you are now achieving shamatha. This is how it's done. And you're not going to waver. You're not going to do anything different. Whether you're on stage 3 or stage 9, you're going to be doing the same thing. Sustaining the flow of mindfulness without distraction, without grasping. That's it. If you're doing that, you're doing it. And then, of course, it gets finer and finer and finer. So, but that, at least you have something of a referent. That is, even at the space of the mind, that's a referent. It's a subtle sign, but it's still a sign. Let alone thoughts, images coming up. But when you withdraw your awareness, even from the space of the mind, and you're simply resting there in the awareness of awareness. Now, I mean, it's called signless. It's called signless for a really good reason, for multiple reasons. Number one, obviously, there's no clear referent apart from your awareness that you're directing your attention to. So that's the explicit meaning. But there's another kind of implicit meaning there. And that is, you're on a road where there are no signposts. You know, 13 miles to your destination, 12 miles to your destination. There's no set. That's just not there, right? And so once again, and now if this need to be emphasized in settling the mind, then all the more in awareness of awareness. Where in Padmasambhava's account of that, he doesn't even mention introspection. Right? All he's saying is, well, you remember what he's saying. He's saying, go right back and read the passage from Natural Liberation. Is just be there. You can do the oscillation as long as that's helpful. And then, just as he says, release your mind into space and leave it there. That was his final bye, you know, and then do this until you achieve shamatha. And so if you're doing that, and you have to be there right in the moment, and so let's imagine that you've released your awareness, released your mind into space, and very clearly, indubitably, that is, with no shadow of a doubt, you are aware that you are aware of being aware. It's not redundant. You're doing the practice, and you know you're doing the practice, and you know you're doing it right. Then that's it. There's no more. And so at that point, don't be thinking about stage one. Don't be thinking about antidotes. Don't be thinking about anything else, including achieving shamatha or how much you'd like to achieve shamatha. Boom. That's why I say that practice, more than any other, is taking the fruit as the path. Because what you're doing simply is bringing forth your best facsimile of having already achieved shamatha. And then let shamatha rise up to meet you. An image that comes to mind, I think it's not that bad, is like being a little fish, just hovering in the middle of the water, and a big fish comes up and swallows you. And the big fish is the substrate consciousness. Swallows the little fish of your coarse mind. So that it kind of rises up to meet you, or since there's no absolute space, the more common metaphor is you descend to it. Again, like that glowing coal. Just without doing anything at all, just keeping bright, don't go dark, keeping bright, and melt your way all the way down to the base of the snowbank. Okay? So no signs. Only when you're out of session, you look back and now put it into your conceptual grid, you know. But when you're there, as much as you do it without elaboration, without cogitation, without evaluation, in the session, keep it real simple. And then it's sweet. And then you're really, I'll end this on the point that I started. When you're doing that and you're doing this in a sustained fashion, then you know, just like tasting chocolate, you know the taste. You don't have to think about it. You know the taste. Or spaghetti. I'm not trying to be fixating on chocolate. but you know the taste. This is a type of knowing that is very clear. It's very direct. And it's one I'm not used to. This is a subtler way of knowing because it's not caught up in a conceptual grid. It's not by way of thinking. But boy, it's direct. And then it becomes kind of obvious, at least conceptually inviting, to understand when one tries to assess this. Aha. So it's not that much of a big leap to go from this mode of knowing, of just awareness resting and awareness knowing awareness, to knowing things intuitively, where you don't know where the knowledge comes from. You're in a conversation with someone. I've had this happen quite a few times. Where you're in a conversation with someone, and you're very attentive. You're giving them full attention. And time again, you know just what they're going to say next. And it's not because they're robotic or just habitual and saying the same old thing. But when you're really in tune with them, listening very closely, body language, facial expression, just being very present with them, they'll say one word and then you know it's coming. You know, it happens quite frequently. And you have no idea how do you know that? I don't know. It's just what came to mind. That I just knew that. And then it's not infallible. Sometimes people surprise you and say, in which case, I thought I knew, but I didn't. But quite frequently, yeah, you knew. And it's intuitive. It's out of that mode of knowing. Okay? Very good. Enjoy your day. I'll see you at 4:30.